Hugh Lawson is in the house. We recorded this in person. What an amazing guy Hugh is. His parents are Jamaican. He came to Canada, and you're really going to enjoy his insights, his knowledge, his wisdom. He drops a bunch of African proverbs that he lives his life by, and he really does follow Ikaga. If you don't know what Ikaga is, you're going to want to listen to this. It can truly transform your life. Hugh, I appreciate you. Thanks for being on the pod, my man. Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line.
And we're live.
And we're live. And, you know, we have Hugh Lawson in the house. Hugh, thanks for joining the It's Not a Straight Line podcast. You know, if I understand it correctly, you're a purpose-driven leader. You're a business development expert. You're a mentor, a lifelong learner, a Vanier Cup champion.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Still look like you could strap on the pads and have a good time.
I got a girdle on.
Social justice advocate, keynote speaker. You know, I don't want to build your head up too high. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here, man. It's good to be here. Good to be here.
You were just commenting on how, you know, there's an exit door right there.
I'm just looking here. It's the first podcast I've seen with a door behind in the backdrop. So if things don't work out, you could just ask me to leave. It's like, okay, get out.
Maybe I should change the name of the podcast, right? Where you can just exit door right? Or door
Yeah. Actually, you're dating yourself now because that's, I was telling a friend about I was bringing around memory lane about a cartoon, a Hanna-Barbera cartoon called Snagglepuss.
Yeah.
Have you remember that one?
No.
No? Okay.
Snagglepuss.
Now I'm really dating myself. It's a Gen X thing. It's basically this very flamboyant lion. It was somewhat cowardly, but every time he was like, he knew it was time for him to leave before danger ensued, he always go, exit, stage left. But it's very stereotypical. I don't think any of these cartoons would have ever made it to the screen in this day and age. Like, they just were. I'm actually shocked when I look back in hindsight that they put those kind of content in front of kids. But anyways, I digress.
Why don't we start off with what you're up to now? Like, you know, I've gotten to know you through sponsorship conferences in Canada. Yeah. You've always been incredibly generous with your time. And, you know, I know you do a lot for the Black Talent Initiative, too, which I believe a mutual contact of us, Mark Harrison, kind of created and led.
Yes, sir.
What are you up to now? What keeps you busy? You just grabbed a lunch today? You're telling me about all these people you hang out with?
Yeah, so I'm actually in an entrepreneurial chapter right now in my life. So I am also participating in a board readiness cohort program. And one of, I guess, the OGs that came in to talk to the cohorts, she used the term portfolio phase because she's long retired and she works with big boards. She's a member of the big boards and she's in her 60s. And she says, well, you're now in the portfolio phase of your life. So what that means is essentially rather than doing one thing with one organization, you're doing multiple things within a portfolio that add up to a bit. So in September 2022, I started a leadership advisory practice and with just particularly helping small organizations with their revenue growth efforts. At the same time, I was also working in the private healthcare space. Did that for a year in a leadership role for a network of treatment centers and addiction facilities. And November 2023, that ended. And I decided to do this full time. But what I did between November and January is I tweaked it and pivoted a little bit. So I do revenue growth advisory for what I call social impact organizations. Anybody who needs to, grow their revenue, go from startup to scale up, or they're a non-for-profit and they need to have other sources of income.
Yeah.
And then essentially what we're doing is generating revenue, helping them generate revenue, but they're doing social impact. Like, it has to be an organization that's going to make the world a better place. So that's what I'm doing. So I have about 4 or 5 clients right now that I'm supporting, and I'm now my 3rd month full time, and I'm really enjoying it. And it gives me the bandwidth to do other things like board readiness and any sort of volunteer or mentorship or just volunteerism, whatever it takes, you know. So I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it.
And so is that through Hilco?
No. So Hilco is a charitable organization that was founded by my brother.
Yeah.
And it was in Hilco, the acronym in Hilco is Hugh and Eileen Lawson Charitable Organization. So I'm Hugh Jr. So my dad, Hugh Sr., is the H. My mom, Eileen, is the I. And essentially what my brother Mark did is he set up this charitable organization so we can give scholarships. So that's another aspect where I do speaking engagements, and the honorariums that we're trying to generate from that will go towards the Hilco Foundation. So,
and then those honorariums, where do you grant the money to? Like, what types of causes?
There's different organizations. So particularly a lot of them are flowing through Jamaica Canadian Association.
Okay.
Who my dad was a member for 25 plus years.
Wow.
So every summer, JCA, that's what they're called as an acronym, they give out about $250,000 of scholarships. So there's a number of organizations that support the JCA. So the JCA will vet the candidates, present them to the scholarship recipients, present the scholarship recipients to us. And then we choose, and then we award them scholarships. So we do that every year. So
speaking of that, you were telling me before that your dad and your mom are from Jamaica, but you were born here, were you born?
Yes. My brother and I were born in Toronto. Yeah.
What was it like growing up as a Jamaican Canadian? Did you consider yourself that, or how did you consider yourself?
So I mean, I considered myself many things, but so
what's one of the quirky things you consider yourself?
Well, it's just, I think during the various stages of your career, your childhood, sometimes you feel Canadian, sometimes you don't feel Canadian. My parents, it's an interesting journey they took to come to Canada. So my parents were educated in England, so they're part of that Windrush generation that immigrated from Jamaica to England to go to school. So they went to school in the 1960s. My mom was a nurse. My dad was an electrical engineer. They met in London, and they got married in London, and then they moved to Canada in 1966. So they married in 66, came here. And then my brother and I were born here in Toronto. But then, I guess for opportunities, and I don't know if Canada was quite ready for immigrants, they decided to move back to Jamaica. So we moved back to Jamaica in the early 70s. And then...
Wait, how long were they in Canada then?
So they're in Canada for like 6 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they left in 1972. In 1973, just after my brother was born, we moved back to Jamaica. We lived there for 5 years, and Jamaica just burst into flames, like just political unrest. Like if you had a chance to watch the Bob Marley biopic, it was roughly a year, the 2-3 years after there was like the peak of civil unrest in Jamaica, where there was actually an assassination attempt on his life in Jamaica. Like, I lived in Jamaica during that time, so I was a child then. And it was at that point where my mom was like, we're not safe here, so let's move back to Canada. Like, we need to move back to Canada. I don't think my dad was ready to move back to Canada, but we did. So we came back in 1977, and then we've been back here ever since.
What do you think that was like for your father if he wasn't ready to
just
move?
I think... like a lot of embattled husbands, like if you're a dedicated spouse, you got to do what you got to do, right? So what do they say? Happy wife, happy life. So however he felt.
That's what people keep telling me.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah. Like I think the key to, someone told me, I wasn't married yet at the time, but I was in line at a Jamaican restaurant, and I remember this. It was maybe 2 years before I got married, and there was a couple arguing in front of me, and it was a lineup as always in this food court. It's Jamaica. It was a box lunch place. So this couple in front of me, they're arguing, and then there's this elderly Jamaican man behind me, and I look at him, and he's shaking his head. He's like, I guess he was just not pleased with the fact this couple in front of us arguing, and he says to me, son, you know what the key is to having a successful relationship? I'm like, I don't know. He goes, you have to get in the last word. And I was thinking to myself, no. And he goes, you want to know what that last word is? And I said, no, I don't. He says, yes, dear.
Yes, dear.
So
that's so good.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that always stayed with me. But whatever it is or however my dad felt, he took it to the grave. So we'll never know. But, I mean, we came back. And when you ask about the fact that, you know, how did I feel? I think for a lot of young people or just people in general, when they come to a new country, and you're treated a way that you weren't accustomed to be treating. I knew at an early age that I was different. Like, I knew right away by how I was being treated by the other kids. So if I think about it, I was 8 at the time. I still felt Jamaican. However, coming to Canada, it was the summer of 77. So the music, it was in the heart of summertime. I think it was like June we came. So the FM radio had music I'd never heard before. Like I remember.
Like when you were here.
Yeah, like, yeah, in Jamaica, yeah. All you heard was my parents, you know, my dad had an eclectic taste for music. Like he had jazz, blues, reggae, calypso, country music. But I never heard classic rock before. Like I never heard of Fleetwood Mac. I never heard of Jerry Rafferty, ELO, Supertramp. Like all that was on the FM dial that summer. So it was just sensory overload with like FM rock. So that was very stimulating, and that drew me into, you know, Canadian culture. Even just the Canadian acts like April Wine, Chilliwack, Rush. So I was listening to all this rock as a kid. And I knew I was born in Canada, so I always had an affinity. But when you came back and then certain things would happen to you, certain things would be said to you, that's when you realize, okay, you're different. And I was 8. Like I when I look at an 8-year-old child to have that much flowing through their neural pathways, it's a bit much. So I mean, it alternated. It depended on the day of the week and how nice the kids were or how not nice the kids were. Sometimes you felt Canadian, sometimes you felt more Jamaican, right? Yeah.
And did you have siblings with you?
Yeah, my younger brother, Mark.
Yeah. Younger brother. And then, you're 8. What, where are you living in Ontario?
Mississauga.
So Mississauga, Ontario, yeah. Canada, yeah. For the huge global listenership, you know, here,
yeah,
on
Mississauga's
the show.
Yeah, Mississauga's the outskirts of Toronto. I know you got some followers in,
you know,
in
you'd
Moldova.
Be surprised. They come, yeah. Actually, the lady that lives just up there to the right's from Moldova,
mm-hmm.
Which is so interesting. But so you come here.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're in high school. When did you start to realize, hey, I'm a pretty good football player?
When we were, the one thing I remember when we first came back to Canada, It was almost like a townhouse project, and they called it the Square. So it was surrounding townhouses, and then you had this open asphalt area. So you'd play football there, street hockey, baseball. So I think it was at the time where you realized which sports you really liked. And then for me, I like soccer because we played soccer in Jamaica, but I started to gravitate towards football because all the players looked like me. So most kids growing up in the city, or you follow the Leafs, but nobody on the Leafs looked like me. Like I knew someone on the Dallas Cowboys looked like me.
Yeah.
Someone on the Buffalo Bills looks like me. So I ended up following that, and then where we really, my brother and I really started to focus on football was, it was when we realized how corrupt the house leagues were for soccer in Mississauga. Because when you play house league, it's a lottery system. You're supposed to end up on whatever team that you get allocated to. However, and this is around grade 4, grade 5, grade 6, the team that won the year before, when they moved them up to the next level by age, the best team always had the same players. So something was, the fix was in. And then the kids on that team would just light up everybody else in the league. And then usually the biggest sponsor got those kids. So, yeah, but the thing is that it's kind of sobering and sad to think that an 11-year-old could smell that the fix was in. Because we knew. We just knew, it's like, why is Tonelli Meadows have the same kids than that one Swiss Chalet franchiser the previous year had when we all were in a tier down? So they had the Mississauga Football League, and my brother and I just, Mark actually stayed longer in soccer because he was a really good soccer player. I was okay. But I said, I want to play football. So we moved over, and then we played Mississauga Football League. But the beauty of the Mississauga Football League is that it was almost like conferences. Like you'd have a Northeast team, you have a Northwest team, you have the Southeast team, Southwest team. And then basically it was jurisdiction. So wherever you lived, luckily, the best quadrant was where we lived, which was Southwest. So within Southwest, you had three tiers. You had, I think it was Adam, Pee-wee, and Bantam. So Adam's like 9, 10. Pee-wee's, I think it was up to grade 8. And then Bantam is grade 9 and up. So we start playing Pee-wee, and that team was stacked. It was absolutely stacked. Like, it just... undefeated. Like, we're undefeated. Like, we wiped out everybody. So in football, I was on the other end of the spectrum, you know?
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually playing for the teams that had the most stacked decks. And that's when you really fell in love with the sport. Because you fall in love with anything when you're always winning, right? So
do you think you were unique in the fact that you knew things like the fix was in and you were picking up on those things at your age, or was your brother also picking up?
I don't
on
know.
Those things?
I mean, I Mark, we'd have to ask him, but yeah, I just knew, like, you could tell something was up. And I think kids are a lot smarter than we give them. Like, you hear about, you know, maybe couples going through a divorce and how much it affects the kids. And in many cases, how the kids will often feel that it's their fault. There's a level of intellectual sophistication that is needed to feel that way. So, yeah, I'm sure other kids felt the same way too. Because if you notice, like, when you talk about sport, I mean, you got a close background and affinity to sport too, is most kids exit competitive sports at around age 13. And it's not their parents saying, oh, you can't do this anymore, we're short on funds. It's mostly the kids saying, I won't do this anymore. So that requires some sort of deep decision, you know.
So interesting. And yeah. I'm sure you can look back on your sport career, and I can look back on mine, which, you know, I didn't even play university sports, but a lot of my leadership experience came from either being a coxie in the rowing team when high school, you know, played baseball. I was the guy that sat in the front that yelled the commands.
But that was leadership,
steered,
right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when did you think you'd have it? Did you always know, like, hey, I might have a shot playing in university ball?
Well, I mean, I always wanted to play college ball. Like, it was a dream, because then if you play college, then you could play pro. But I think, like a lot of kids growing up, they had a design on, oh, I'm going to get a scholarship here, and then I'm going to get drafted by this NFL team or CFL team. So you always had the dream, but I think for a lot of student athletes around maybe grade 11, grade 12, that's when you kind of knew, okay, I might be onto something here, or yeah, nah, it's not gonna work out. Like, I killed that dream.
Yeah.
So I would say later stages of high school. And what for position? Me, it was my last year. I was a defensive end and a tight end.
Defensive end and tight end.
But my I always dreamt of going to the next level. But in my last year of high school, I think that's when I realized it was possible, because that's when you start getting recruited, right? And people start calling, or your coach says, hey, this university wants to talk to you and your parents. So yeah, it was like towards the end of high school.
And so, you know, before it was CIS or CIA, and then CIA, it was U Sports, yeah. And I'm not sure if it went back now to like
U Sports, it's still yeah.
U Sports, yeah. And they have the OUA.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like? You know, what did your parents think about when you were like, hey, I'm going to be able to play university ball and I'm going to go to Laurier?
Well, they just cared
by a few schools,
well,
right?
Yeah, I did. But they just cared about the school. Like they just wanted, like, university. There was no other option. Like, you had to go to university. Like, that was it. If the sports was a means of you getting to university. Because we weren't hard up for money. Like my parents did okay, middle class. But then my dad worked at Petro-Canada. And Petro-Canada would have scholarships for employees' kids. So it wasn't, we didn't even have OSAP. We didn't use OSAP. So money wasn't an issue. It was just more the choice of school. And so I was recruited by schools in province. And then the only school out of province, I think there were some maritime schools, but Simon Fraser.
Which is a great football school,
is it
not?
It was a great football program. Yeah, yeah. It's defunct now. Like they went under about a year ago. But I'm just thinking a story. But I don't know if this coach is still alive. Like, so recruiters, I mean, you're in partnerships. My background's BD. There's a nuance to pitching and trying to build rapport with people. Some do it well. Some do it not so well. It requires a lot of self-awareness and a decent level of emotional intelligence. And actually, the successful recruiter, which was, his name was Tom Arnott, I learned a lot about business development just by how he courted me and how organic he was. It wasn't forced. He didn't lie to me. He was actually very honest with me. He's like, look, you're underweight. Our school has a strong, deep roster of defensive linemen. So you're gonna have to understudy. And like all our linemen, great linemen, you'll probably hit your stride in your third year. And I didn't have a problem with that. But other schools are like, oh, you're going to start first year. I was like 195 pounds soaking wet. There's no way I was going to start my first year. But there's this one school.
How tall are you? 195, 6'3", 195.
So like wide receivers.
Where do they think you should be?
Well, yeah. I mean, you got to be like 230, 250.
Really?
Yeah. So you got to put on some weight. So you got to lift and everything. So yeah, that's going to take a couple of years. You got to grow into your body, right? And then you get on a regimen. But I remember, actually, you know, just to be safe, in case this coach is still alive, but people can put two and two together. But it was a school in BC. They played in the States. Actually, we already told it was Simon Fraser. So the head coach flies out, comes and visits us at our home. And he was a little curmudgeon. I don't think in hindsight he should have came by himself. I think he needed like someone to support him with a little bit more the chutzpah. Yeah. So he sits down with my parents, you know, Jamaican immigrants, talking to them and then he starts pissing and moaning about how he has to recruit out of province. It's hard to find football players in BC, especially in Vancouver, because everybody's Asian in Vancouver. So we're looking at him going, oh, and you're a racist as well too. So yeah, he immediately lost the room because it's like, there's no way in hell I'm going to send my kid across the country and trust him in your care. And then on top of that, the school is really remote. And then the other, it just goes to show you just the lack of polish or finesse that organizations would have. But the other thing was they sent a kid who we played against in high school, who is now a scholarship athlete at the school,
to come talk to myself and a couple of the players on my team. But they didn't realize that they sent a disgruntled student athlete who was horribly homesick. So he sat us down in our school library and proceeded to tell us about how there is no Jamaican food in this part of BC. There are no black people. He doesn't get to see his parents for 6 months at a time. But yeah, we really want you to come to this school. So literally they took themselves out in like two fell swoops. But
I don't think they realized that one day the best kicker in the NFL would be of Asian descent either.
Well, it was just
guy from Atlanta, I think.
Yeah, but it was just so short-sighted. But
so short-sighted.
Yeah, it was so short-sighted, and I don't know.
But I gotta imagine that was pretty common at the time. Or was it not?
Well, I mean, yeah, there was. I mean, yeah, there's a race. It was the 80s. Like it was, yeah, racism was fairly rampant. It wasn't massively overt, but there were moments. But this one was, yeah, it was just a very primitive form of ignorance where someone's thinking, okay, I'm going to speak ill about one ethnic group and assume that this ethnic group would be fine with that. Like it, and then be surprised when they decide not to send their kid to your school. But, you know, it was there. When you went to school, a lot of things happened in the locker room, happened on the field, happened on campus. My second semester, my first year, my cousin was shot and killed by police in Mississauga. And
seriously?
Yeah, Wade Lawson. He was shot in the back of the head. And that, I don't even know how I made it to second year, because that put me into an abyss for the second semester, just trying to come to grips with that. And that was like a big deal. And yeah, the university years were very formative years. Like a lot of reflection, a lot of transformation, a lot of reckoning. It was also second year was the LA riots, and that really affected me. Like just watching it on TV, realize it, just the verdict. And those years were some very formative years for just sort of self-awareness. I think I was having dinner with a good friend of mine, and we were just talking about how childhood trauma really, really forms who we are as adults. And the fact that some of the most driven people, some of the most intense people, people that are just relentless or have some sort of, you know, focus or like roadmap or North Star that is just otherworldly. Like other people just go, how do they keep maintain that pace? Like what's driving them? A lot of it is trauma. Yeah. A lot is trauma. Look at anybody who's had immense success. There's something that happened when they're a child.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about that, and she said to me, she didn't admit what it was, but she says, yeah, and she's very successful. And yeah, those years, I think when I look at what I'm doing now and why I'm doing what I'm doing, I think a lot of that was formed. As a matter of fact, a lot of it was formed when I first came to Canada, because I saw some things. Like I saw some things that were really overt, like Mississauga in the late 70s, early 80s. Nice city, nice town, but as a child from a racialized community growing up in Mississauga, it was tough. It was tough. Not just black kids, South Asian kids. There was just various forms of aggression and downright violence that literally took bullying to a whole nother level. So, and when I think about it, like when I think about the South Asian kids that I grew up with, we all grew up in this immigrant, middle class, working class neighborhood. They're all multimillionaires now. They're all multimillionaires, and they don't live in this country anymore. Really? They went to California, built businesses, sold them for millions and millions of dollars. And why is that? Why is it like you're talking about a part of Mississauga that substantiated maybe like a 50 square kilometer radius, and you have all these multimillionaires that lived in, they had educated parents, came here from another country, in many cases exiled. Like a lot of the kids I grew up with that were South Asian were from sub-Saharan Africa. So basically they got pushed out when African regimes were taken over, you know, like at Idi Amin, or, and then they're forced off their land. But all of them have become multimillionaires. And you wonder, like, where did that drive come from? It probably came from trauma, you know?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
And so it was your cousin, he was shot by police.
Yeah.
And were you close with your cousin?
Yeah, I mean, we were all the same age. He was closer to my brother's age.
Yeah.
And, you know, his mom was a hairdresser. She had a really successful salon in Mississauga. He ran with a different crowd, but he was a good kid. And he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But he got shot in the back of the head. And the car was stolen. But to this day, we only have one account of what happened. We don't know what really happened. But the part of him being shot in the back of the head, that to this day doesn't make sense. But when it happened, it just changed everything. It changed everything, the way you looked at things, just how you felt about the world. I think when you think of how people have suffered greatly during COVID, but we're much more empathetic and aware of the importance of mental health. Yeah, like there was none of that back then. I think I basically just read a lot. Like I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and that helped me get out of it. But I barely made it through the semester. I'm shocked I didn't fail out of school.
So did you experience a lot of mental health, Hugh?
During that time, if I look back, yeah, I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Because there was no one to help me diagnose it. But family was there for me. We have a pretty strong family unit.
Yeah.
But in this day and age, you're so much more aware and acute to what mental health and when you're under mental distress and what you have to do to get through it. So
yeah, it's
these times
funny.
Are a lot different.
Right? Yeah, and a lot of people that have been on the podcast, and even myself, I speak about, you know, it's not a straight line. It's both careers and life. But for me, it's been, you know, bouts of depression and anxiety throughout my life. And there's been a lot of other people that have spoken about it. And it is true. Now there's, you know, where to kind of go for help.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as spoken about. And there's still a stigma.
Big time, yeah.
And actually, someone else on here, Dina Bella Ross, she's a sport communications PR expert.
Nice.
But she's actually gotten certified in the study of death. And she's a coach on grieving. And she's actually written a book on it.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes as far as speaking about, it's not even sometimes that you lost someone. It could be you lost a job. It could be that, you know, she works with some pro female soccer players.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a great career and now you're 35 and it's done. And what do you do?
Yeah.
That's grieving too.
Identity loss, they call it.
Identity loss.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm fortunate through my work at the Princess Margaret to have met the Carnegie family and Rain Carnegie and Bernice. Mm-hmm. So Bernice is the daughter of
Herb. Yeah.
And, you know, they speak about how Rain was relentless with getting Herb into the Hall of Fame after George Floyd. That was his wake up call because they tried to get Herb in and they wouldn't get him in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've actually watched, if you haven't seen it, it's called Beyond Their Years. It's the documentary of Buck O'Neill.
Yeah, I saw it.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And I've got to ask you, though, when it was COVID, tough time for a lot of us, and you're seeing what's happening south of the border, and you remember what happened to your cousin, like, sit with someone like you?
Oh, no, that was a... That was a boost bottle. That was a boost button for me. Like George Floyd shook me to my core because I'm the same size as George Floyd. I think first it was Ahmaud Arbery because I used to run, and I'd run at like the weirdest times of the night. And I just remember after Ahmaud Arbery was murdered, my family was very concerned. Cause they're like, you're not going to go running, are you? Like, everybody was afraid. And then when it was just one after the other, and then Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, and the combination of that and being cooped up, it was like a powder keg for a lot of people. Like, even like to this day, I haven't watched the video. I can't. I don't know what would happen if I did. But the event itself and the subsequent murder, like it just everybody just doubled down. Really say, okay, enough. Like, and the thing is that oftentimes when we talk about these incidents, we always highlight the fact that it's south of the border. But atrocities like that happen in Tehran all the time. As a matter of fact, like you and I driving a car at maybe 9 o'clock tonight, same car, I'm 20 times more likely to be caught or pulled over by a cop. And I've been pulled over quite a bit. I don't have a Bugatti. I got 11-year-old Chrysler. But yeah, I've had my fair share of being pulled over in my own neighborhood, blocked in the driveway of my home. And I'm an executive coming home from a business trip, just closing a multi-million-dollar deal. But because the flight was delayed by 2 hours, my flight from Calgary landed at 1 a.m. So I'm driving home at 2 a.m, subsequently being pulled over and asked, well, what are you doing driving out this late at night in this neighborhood? So, and that wasn't 50 years ago. That was 8 years ago. So it happens. It happens. And I think a lot of people could relate to that. A lot of good came from it. Like, that's how I got close to Mark and Black Talent Initiative, because he immediately got to work and launched that organization after George Floyd. And I think a lot of us, our sentiments and our feelings weren't new after George Floyd. We just were emboldened to truly express how we felt and why we needed change, and made us brave and vigilant to drive change. It was a catalyst. It was a spark. So like everybody you see, it'd be fascinating to do a study to see the personas of the people that you see in this, like say the sponsorship marketing community, that are Black, you know, and see how they conduct themselves before and all the extra work they're doing after. It's within proximity of George Floyd's death. Like after, it's almost like BCAD. It's like BFAF. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, thank you for sharing so openly and sharing what happened to your cousin. And, you know, we could go on with this conversation for hours. And I think you'll have to come back to the house and we can do this again. But, you know, I don't want to glaze over this either. I also want to get to, you know, some of, I think, the key insights you have, and then get to a couple quick questions and get you out of here.
Yeah, but, no problem.
But you won the Vanier Cup.
Yeah. Yep.
So props to that, my man.
Nice.
You know, five words or a sentence. What did it feel like when you guys won the Vanier Cup?
It's a good question. It was so long ago.
Can you remember the game? Even though it was so long ago, can you remember the game?
There's so many aspects of the game that I remember. One was, what I do recall was a lot of our players were injured. So we were taped up, especially on the offensive side. But what I do recall, what I remember very vividly was, you know, they had to intro this, you know, they always introduce the starting lineup. So they introduced the starting defense for us, and they introduced the starting offense. It was Mount Allison. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mount Allison. So I think they called us out first. But we were all in the just sort of like this holding area, and it was like this petri dish of just aggression and just rage. And man, we used to talk a lot of smack. Like we were very verbose team, and we were chirping at him. We were chirping, and I don't know if it was because a lot of the players were Francophone and their English, because it was a bilingual school, right? I believe Mount Allison's in Sackville, in Nova Scotia, but a lot of the the head coach was a Francophone, so they had a lot of French kids on the team. So I don't know if they were like, but they looked scared. And we were chirping. Yeah, we were chirping. Like, we were chirping. They were quiet. They weren't chirping back. And we're calling out numbers, like literally like it was a prison yard. And I just remember when they start calling out our names, the adrenaline, like, we were so amped. And as a result, we really got a leg up on them. Like, I think the defense, they couldn't get anything on us in the first half. Because I think they spent the first half just getting used to the stadium. We played in the dome the week before against Queens, so we're used to the dome. When we played against Queens, it was almost, we were Mount Allison in that we fell behind at half. And I think we spent most of the first half just adjusting to being in the dome. But the other thing that worked against Mount Allison was that there's 30,000 people in the stands, and they're all Laurier. It's a small school, but it has a huge alumni base in the city. Like, even the other thing I remember was, and this would never happen today with sports science and nutritional science, but there was a high-ranking VP at McDonald's that was like a VP of marketing or something, and somehow he worked it out that the whole team could go to the McDonald's in the dome and eat for free. So the week before, or no, three, four, five, 4 days before the game, they took us to the McDonald's in the dome, and it was like a special McDonald's, and they just kept coming out with plate, like trays and trays of burgers. So it was like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like, we just kept eating because it was free. Like, it was free. Like, when you're a student, it's about food scarcity, right? So each of us must have ate like four Big Macs. And then we stayed in the Skydome Hotel, and everybody got sick. And when you think about it, I think it was like 10 years later, they had that documentary, Supersize Me, where like a guy basically ate McDonald's for a whole month and almost died. A lot of us died in those hotel bathrooms, several deaths. And I'm surprised that we're in any shape to play. I also remember from that was the camaraderie of the team. Like, the team was very close, and we're also very prone to pranking. So we were like jokers. Like, we had fun. Like, we chirped a lot, but we had a lot of fun. A lot of really humorous guys on the team, like a lot of different characters. So, and then a lot of people from different walks of life. So we had farm boys, we had kids from the city, we had kids from Medoc, Ontario, Tillsonburg, Scarborough, Mississauga, Waterloo, local kids, and everybody, it was a well-oiled tight unit that overcame a lot of injuries. But when it was done, that was our Super Bowl, because the stadium was probably full than most CFL games. Yeah, it was 30. There's a lot of people, and it was loud. And I remember at the end of the game, my chest hurt because the air quality in the dome was different. It was artificial
air.
It
wasn't the McDonald's?
No, McDonald's. there are other orifices that were affected by the McDonald's. The air affected my ability to breathe in my lungs, but I just remember being sore. I remember everybody partied. I didn't party. I was just pretty low-key. A girlfriend at the time, we just hung out. We went where they had a celebration in the athletic center when the buses came back to Waterloo. And then I think I went to sleep. I was just really tired because I was on. But yeah, that was something. And to this day, like, the guys get all together. It's been, this year will be 33 years since the Vanier Cup. And
so was it 1991?
Yeah.
And it was at Skydome, yeah. 30,000 people.
Yeah.
And if my research serves me correct, yeah, the defense really carried the team. Is that true? Or is this another team I heard about?
The offensive unit was very talented.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, when all of the kids on that team hit their peak and went pro, there was a substantial more proportion of offensive kids that played in the CFL. But they were a year younger that year. So the defense was really formidable, and it was at its peak. You had fifth-year guys, you had fourth-year guys, you had third-year guys, And actually, all the injuries were pretty heavily weighted on the offensive side. So until they hit their stride, like we carried through like key moments. Like the defensive unit was really good.
And yeah. I think, Hugh, what I've heard you say about football and sport in general and how it relates to business and leadership is you know when you're on the defense what hole you have to cover who you're covering.
Yeah.
And you know you have to work as a unit to get to that next level. And I think that's an important lesson in business today.
Yeah, I think what I've watched over the years and often really struggled seeing people get it wrong is where one person has to have the spotlight, one person has to get the credit. You see this today, like even in professional sports, you see how each sport is marketed differently. Like basketball is marketed a lot differently, or the philosophy of the league as to how they market their athletes and their teams is a lot different. Like I think with hockey and football, it's less about the individual. Like the individual dude, like, I mean, you're in partnership. So you know that, you know, you're working with athletes as individuals and kids look up to them, but the team, everybody has a role to play and not everybody gets to take the shot. And for us, especially as a defensive player, like I had my assignment. There's moments where you could literally see the quarterback, like he was literally like an arm length away from you. And you're thinking, if I just shot this gap, I could make a big play and that could end up on the 11 o'clock news and it'll be a sack, which will count towards my sack totals. But then you also knew with the schemes that if you went inside and shot that gap and you were responsible for contain, which essentially means you can't let a quarterback or anybody else with the ball get to the outside of the field, because once they get to the outside and they turn the corner, they're gone. So it was known as you had contained responsibility. Or if an offensive lineman shot inwards and there's this huge gaping hole in front of you, you knew you couldn't jump in there. You had to hold your station because more than likely it's a trap. Like if an offensive lineman is going inwards and there's a huge hole, A defensive lineman that didn't do their homework will go, oh my gosh, look at all the open field. There's a quarterback right there. And then they run in. And the minute they run in, there's a pulling guard coming from the other side that just wipes them out. And then there's a huge hole and a big play. So you always stayed home. So in terms of equating to that to work in life is that it really taught you how to play within a system where the final outcome was success. And more than likely, the final outcome would be team success as opposed to you making a big play in the backfield and maybe getting some sort of award or all-star designation. And the thing was that even from an individual accolade standpoint, if you played your part and you played your role in the system, people noticed, and then you eventually got the individual nod. So when we played in a system, a whole bunch of us still got all-star nods and conference all-star nods because we were sound players. Like we were sound players. We followed our assignments. We made few mistakes. And then we also made big plays when it was our time to make big plays. So it was more of an overall holistic effort as opposed to like just being a shooting star at everybody else's expense. So yeah, I'm not surprised that a lot of the teammates of mine 30 years later have all had immense personal success, like in academics, commerce, life, entrepreneurship. A lot of guys on our team have done really, really well in life.
And you know what's pretty cool, like, you know, with the podcast, if it's not a straight line, you can only connect the dots looking back is what I believe. You said some really interesting things. One is some of the people that experienced the hardest traumas and challenges, whether they're from the South Asian community, West Indies, wherever they're from, went on to have incredibly successful and impactful careers.
Something fueled them from that,
You know, I look at what you mentioned Mark Harrison, who's an expert in sponsorship and experiential marketing in Canada. You know, you had that cousin that was shot and some other things that happened, as well as, you know, even though you didn't watch the video of George Floyd, you clearly know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, we haven't even talked much about what you're doing now, but now you're an incredibly purpose-driven servant leader, if I can explain you like that.
Mm-hmm.
You're speaking to me before we went on the record here, or we hit record, about a Nigerian student you're putting in front of business contacts. You could have gone a very different route mm-hmm. in terms of being angry, especially after your cousin.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't get angry. I mean, we all...
You got angry,
it was like the stages of loss.
Stages of grief. Stages of loss.
Yeah.
And of course, whenever those things happen, you're going to get enraged, and you deservedly so. But, you know, I'll throw it over to you before I ask the final few questions, mm-hmm. but... You've been a business development executive. Mm-hmm. You played a little bit with the Toronto Argonauts.
For a minute,
cup of coffee. And we spoke a lot about football and the lessons mm-hmm. of that and the lessons of coming to the country.
Mm-hmm.
What are you most proud of that you're working on now? I know you're working as an advisor and shareholder in Tradish. Shout out to Peter Huang, who I met through you. EQO. What are you most proud that you're working on now, and what are you looking forward to?
I'm proud of all of them. I like just the journey that I'm on, just to live a life with purpose. It didn't start with George Floyd. It started from a very young age because my parents were very civic minded. So it was all I knew and all I ever saw were people that would do their job, raise a family, but they would also do civic work, whether it's joining a community group or being a member of a cultural association. So that was always around my brother and I. So that was kind of became a part of our DNA. But in 2016, I stumbled on a Japanese philosophy known as Ikigai, which is like the intersection of what the world needs, what you're good at, what you love and what you can get paid to do. And then I chased that for 7 years. And it had so many different iterations, whereas I was doing a lot at work, helping some people at work, mentoring people at work, but then doing a lot of things off the side of my desk. And then after George Floyd, that was a bit of an awakening where it's like, well, I just want to do this. And there's no reason I can't make a difference and earn a living at the same time, where it's like a intersection. You do good and you do well at the same time. So I chased it. And then I was in the B2B space at Staples, and I still felt I wasn't there yet. I wanted my day job to be more purposeful. Staples, in its way, as a corporation, has its purposeful aspects to it, but not full on. I mean, it's just... Yeah, but you know, that you shout out to the different ERG groups they had there. But I just wanted to do that for the next chapter. And then the next thing that occurred was my father passed in 2018. And when he passed, he was a pretty quiet, low-key guy. But it's interesting. You really see the mark of a person by who shows up at the funeral. So that person could have been chirping and saying a lot of things and, you know, amplifying themselves, but you really see the impact they've had by who came to the funeral. And it's not necessarily a matter of quantity, it was more quality. And that really stayed with me because he was a good man, and he left a legacy to the point where I grieved, but the grieving wasn't prolonged because it was more celebration and also inspiration. So I was like, okay, I'm in a legacy mode, so I've moved into healthcare, did that for a year. But what I'm proud of today is that everybody I'm working with right now are incredible human beings, and they're all trying to make some sort of social impact. And that's all I work with now. I just work with people who are driving social impact organizations. So when you look at Tradish as an example, Tradish has this ecosystem supporting food entrepreneurs who are greatly impacted and affected by COVID, who maybe were shuttered, their businesses were shuttered, or they were furloughed from a restaurant. but they still had the gumption and the resilience to keep their businesses going. And this platform is a means for them to amplify and also provide resources and support to market and sustain their businesses virtually and online. However, as of recent, and this is Peter driving all this and the Tradeish team, everything they're doing is driven by impact. But at the same time, it's a for-profit company. And at some point in time, it will be acquired and bought. To me, that's Ikigai, because there was a need for it in the world. There's a passion and love behind it. A lot of it driven by Peter's parents and the journey they had coming to Canada from South Korea, struggling in the food business for decades. And then it's a culmination of what people are good at. Like, there's a lot of firepower in that Tradeish team. Peter has built and exited many companies. So he has decades of experience building things from scratch and making them operationally sound and then having them launch and execute. There's nobody better at execution and operational efficiency than Peter. But at the same time, Peter's a very generous man. So that's Ikigai. And everybody that I work with are all in that same stratosphere. So what I'm really proud of right now is I get to work with incredible people and I get to help and support them. And I can earn a living doing it. And when it's all said and done, people, communities, organizations are better off because of the work that we're all collectively doing, but not doing it at a loss. The other thing I learned very quickly, especially being in the healthcare space, is that there's something to be said about being at the intersection, because sometimes if you spend so much time in what the world needs, it might be at the expense of getting paid, which from a long-term perspective gets in the way of giving people what they need, because in order for you to give people what they need, you have to be solvent. So you have to do, while you're doing good, you should also be doing well, right? So
is that what solvent means?
It's like solvent, like your business. I mean,
I see what you're saying. Yeah, like, yeah. Like
you can't help someone with treatment if you're locked out of your facility.
Yeah.
You have to earn a living. And
it's so true.
Yeah, and you should not be ashamed helping people and earning a living at the same time. And that's what Ikigai is for me. So what I'm proud of is that I feel for the first time, I think I'm pretty close to cracking the code on Ikigai. And it's a great feeling. It's a great feeling when you're helping people. And then the other thing too is doing it without jurisdiction. Like the way my business is set up, I don't have to stay in Canada. Like next month, I'll be in Riyadh. I'll be in Riyadh for 4 days at a conference.
Yes.
If I can get over to Kigali for Giants of Africa, I'd love to be there. Oh. You know, if I go to Singapore for there's this global village of just incredible human beings trying to make an impact on the world, and I get to be a part of it. So I'm blessed. You know, I'm blessed.
That's incredible. And you know, I know you're also a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as we close out the podcast and the show, if people want you to, number one, speak, want to get in touch with you about anything they're doing, what's the best way to reach you?
Just holler at me on LinkedIn. Just put me in the name search, send me a name. There are not too many. There are Hugh Lawsons on LinkedIn, but I think if you put my name in, I should be one of the bunch that will pop, that get to the top of the rice heap. So yeah, you know where to find me. And then also too, just shout out to some of the organizations I'm working with, do a quick Tradeish plug. They've pivoted. So we've pivoted into this. So how it evolved was in the whole efforts to support the food entrepreneurs, Peter and team created a grocery buying group. So because a lot of food entrepreneurs are just going to the local store, and margins in food and hospitality are already lean to begin with. So it's like, okay, let's put together a buying consortium. They can get double-digit savings on groceries. But then Pete uses the term social impact thesis a lot, and he expanded and evolved the social impact thesis to include opening the grocery buying group to food banks. And then now we're talking to schools, because right now, and then now it's B2C, because through the grocery buying portal, we removed a lot of layers of expenses and laden costs that you'd often see on the retail side. And everybody's suffering from grocery affordability right now. So literally this past week, Tradish has pivoted, and now it is a grocery buying platform for people as well. So
that's
the
kind of
the dope people that I work with right now.
That's incredible. Yeah. And I love that you brought up Ikigai. I think it's so powerful. Yeah. I was watching, there's a Netflix series
the
called
Blue Zones.
And they talk about
Okinawa. It's they live by Ikigai. And anytime people see, a lot of people are very intrigued by entrepreneurship. They're intrigued by what I'm doing. And I'm documenting anything, and I gladly share it, like the blueprint that I'm building for my business. But the question I always ask is, well, how do I know what I'm going to do next? And to me, it's simple. Just follow Ikigai. If you follow Ikigai, everybody has their spirituality. They have, you know, you might be a devout Muslim or a devout Christian or a Buddhist. That's great, and that's beautiful. This could be complementary to that. If you just follow Ikigai, if you can just find something that you can do for a living that the world needs, what you're good at, you know, what you love, and what you can get paid to do, you're good. Just chase that North Star. Yeah.
Well, so Hugh, very grateful for your time.
Thanks for being here.
I got three zigzag questions to close it out.
Yeah, one word
answer or a phrase.
Okay.
Here we go. Your 22 and 19-year-old kids, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
What's one small piece of advice you'd give them about as they enter their careers?
I live my life by African proverbs. I could probably answer your zigzags with an African proverb. The one I think is most important, and actually Chappelle quoted it too. His mom used to quote it to him. Sometimes you have to be a lion so you can be the lamb you truly are.
Wow, that's powerful.
Yeah.
What is one learning throughout your business development career that might have hurt or you might have misstepped that you remember as you progress right now?
I'm going to have fun with this. I'll do another proverb. You can go fast alone or you can go far together. Every major deal we did didn't occur, or wasn't one person wasn't the catalyst. It was a team. All my successes have been with teams.
It's an amazing answer. And I know you're so involved in Black Talent Initiative, and we spoke about that Nigerian student.
Yeah.
If someone's listening to this who's, you know, in their 20s, early 30s, want to grow in their career, they're from you know, the West Indies or somewhere else, and they're part of that visible minority, which in many places in the GTA now is the majority.
Yeah, it's all racialized communities.
What's the small piece of advice you give to them if they feel like they're not being looked at for the next role because of that color of their skin?
And you go back, I'll give you two proverbs. The first proverb is, you got to be a lion to be the lamb you truly are. Raise your voice. What a lot of new arrivals and people from racialized communities, or particularly new arrivals to Canada, what they don't realize is that they were marketed to. Canada wanted them here. It's what's helped us maintain our G8 country status. A lot of new arrivals, and I tell them this because I'm involved with a couple organizations, like Canada knew you were coming before you knew you were coming. You were marketed to. We don't market to things that we don't find worthy of our business, our countries. They have to remember that, and they have to affirm themselves with that, and they have to stand up and make sure that they're not held under the boot of not being able to find work. Like, I think a lot of, it's very easy to feel like a visitor, just because you're constantly being rejected. Do you have Canadian experience? I don't recognize that school you went to. I don't recognize that company you work for in Nigeria or India. However, this goes to the second proverb, a tree with strong roots laughs at storms. You have to look within and remember that you are marketed to. There's a reason why you were convinced to come to this country. You bring value, very high educational levels. It takes a certain ilk of cloth to just get up and go to a whole new country and throw caution to it. Like, you're built different. You have a different kind of resilience DNA. You really have to tap into that. Like, you really have to tap into that and never, ever, 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 ever let anybody make you feel lesser than, because you're not. Like, immigration makes this country great. Immigration raises the levels of our education and academic achievement scores on the planet. And a lot of that is driven by people that are new to this country that hold their children to a higher educational standard. They literally drag our scores up. You have to pull into those roots and fully understand why you're here. And you're not here as an asylum seeker. You are marketed to. You're an asset. So I think that's a thing. Like, a tree strong. Remember your roots. Remember why you were marketed to.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Thank you, Hugh.
All right, man.
Thanks for being on the show.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line, or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it. You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.